from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America lost one of its most beloved neighbors today. For 33 years, kids tuned in to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for lessons in dignity and civility. The gentle, quiet man revolutionized children's television by never talking down to children. In these turbulent times, the youngest Americans may need this comforting message more than ever. Tonight on Point, remembering Fred Rogers. We begin in Turkey, where today a crucial vote was expected by the Turkish parliament on the request by the United States to allow 62,000 U.S. troops access to Turkish soil in preparation for war with Iraq. The vote did not happen, despite urgent calls from Washington for speed in opening access to a northern front in that war. Eileen Prusher is Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her where the Turkish decision now stands.
Actually, it doesn't seem like they've been able to reach a decision, and there might be many really different reasons for that. But in the meantime, it's been put off until Saturday, and tomorrow, Friday, here in Ankara, the Turkish National Security Council is going to meet, and we think that perhaps at that meeting there might be a signal that would give the Turkish parliament a reason to vote now. One of the reasons they haven't voted yet is that the Turkish president, and that is president but not prime minister, has been saying that Turkey, under its constitution, has to have international legitimacy in order to base foreign troops here and to send foreign troops abroad. And by that, it seems that they want to hear or see the passage of a second UN Security Council resolution before okaying this.
Eileen Prusher, is this reaching a crisis point for U.S. troops? How serious a problem is this?
What we have now is U.S. ships waiting off the coast of Turkey to unload a lot of military equipment, and then most of the troops that would accompany that equipment would be flown in. But it does seem to have set the Pentagon schedule behind by several weeks. Now, for the past week to 10 days, the Bush administration has been indicating that at some point, if Turkey does not make a decision, those ships and those troops could be rerouted to another country bordering Iraq, and that perhaps a northern front against Saddam Hussein is maybe preferable but not crucial. And it's possible that if Turkey doesn't make a decision in the next few days, then we could see perhaps a real shift in the Bush administration's war strategy.
Let's tick off the issues for Turkey. First of all, $6 billion in cash has been offered at this point, right up front as far as we understand. Is that enough?
On the one hand, Turkey feels that it really suffered at the end of the Gulf War in 1991. It dealt with a big refugee crisis, and it also lost a big trading partner in Iraq. It also bought in the past a lot of oil from Iraq. They've seen their economy sort of go downhill, and in part they look back to the Gulf War of just over 10 years ago and say, we feel that we've suffered because of this and we might suffer again, so we have to protect ourselves from this kind of losses. But on the other hand, when you say, is it enough, I think that's a very big question. I mean, I've been speaking to, various officials here in Ankara, the capital, and some Turks have been saying things along the lines of, well, that's peanuts for what the U.S. could be offering us. There really is a little bit of discernible tension in the air here over the aid and also, whether or not Turkey really feels ready politically to do this. Mm. Of course, we should mention, as we probably all know by now, about 94-95% of the Turkish public in polls says that it is opposed to a war against Iraq. So this is indeed a difficult thing for the Turkish government to be bringing home to its constituents.
In that case, Eileen Prusher, it's a democracy. Will the parliament feel comfortable or feel compelled to step over that public opposition and vote in favor of this anyway?
From all indications, yes. There have been lots of political reasons for delay here, but if and when the Turkish government brings this to the parliament and there's a vote on it, as we understand it, it will pass in parliament because the ruling AK party has a comfortable majority in the parliament. The truth is that this is a very new party that just came into power last fall with a popular charismatic leader in Tayyip Erdogan and also the Prime Minister Abdullah Gül. I think many of those parliament members are not going to want to cross those leaders.
Eileen Prusher, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Eileen Prusher is Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me earlier today from Ankara, Turkey. There's a generous current in the American spirit, Fred Rogers once said. And if we can simply give voice to that once in a while, I think it's a good message. Fred Rogers gave voice to that message. Every day for 33 years, he invited America's children into his neighborhood for an hour of song, make-believe, and tender life lessons. In the process, he changed TV history. Courteous and compassionate, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood stood fast against the glitzy current of commercial children's programming. American adults might blush when they remember how much they loved that cardigan and those old sneakers, but they also remember how Mr. Rogers spoke with dignity and honesty in a language that made it possible to talk to kids reassuringly about tough times. He was the man America turned to when the country needed help talking to kids about September 11th. And now, with war on the horizon and a terrorist threat unrelenting, we may need that message of dignity, kindness, and integrity more than ever. Fred Rogers died today. He was 74. Was Mr. Rogers part of your childhood, part of your children's neighborhood? Do we still have the capacity for his kind of compassion and humility? Who else, what else on TV today can carry the torch for Fred Rogers? How do we make the kids feel safe now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Earlier today, I spoke with Bob Thompson, professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University and On Point television critic. I asked him to describe the Fred Rogers legacy.
Television and childhood, of course, were linked from the minute television made its way into the living room. And from very close to the beginning, there began to be kind of a battle for how the minds of the American kid was going to be captured. Mm-hmm. On one level, I suppose we can see the two different ways in which that was attempted. One side of the spectrum being Sesame Street, which decided to go with the Madison Avenue flashy, morphing ladybugs and all of the rest of it, kind of getting kids to learn literacy skills the way they got them to want to buy soft drinks and sugared cereal.
And the Mr. Rogers neighborhood side?
Mr. Rogers was the exact opposite. This calm, quiet, comforting place that was really in many ways so unlike any other place on television, certainly after about 1960 or so. Everybody knows now that American television for kids went the Sesame Street route. Mm. Rugrats, SpongeBob, all that Nickelodeon stuff. Mr. Rogers resembles the kinds of local shows for kids that you used to see back in the 1950s, but an attitude that has almost completely disappeared from American life.
And hone in on that attitude. How would you define it?
Well, you know, it's the whole thing is so low budget. He creates this little utopia, but it's not done through special effects and fancy stuff. It's a train set. It's some hand puppets. I mean, this is like the utopia that any kid plays when they go off into their imagination. But what really matters is that this adult comes in, and for one thing, he's so warm and fuzzy. He's literally fuzzy. He dons a cardigan sweater that makes him like a bunny when he gets on there.
Now, it's aimed at kids, and we use that word, but kids is a broad range. What was the age that Fred Rogers had in mind as his target?
Well, I think 5 years and below is essentially
so
what the
very young children.
Very, very young children. And, you know, it's funny because this show becomes very easy to make fun of after you pass its age. Once you become 8, you wouldn't be caught dead watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood by your fellow 8-year-olds. And then, of course, the Saturday Night Live sketches. It's so easy to make fun of because it is so raw and so innocent. But I think all these ironic baby boomer and post-baby boomer people can make fun of the won't you be my neighbor kind of thing. But at the same time, I think there is a very warm place in their heart for this kind of kind uncle that they might not have actually had, who gave them this warm little world when they were kids before their heads had fused.
You talk about a warm little world, and of course that was Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, but it wasn't necessarily the block you lived on. It wasn't necessarily that neighborhood.
It absolutely wasn't. I mean, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was, in fact, a show that was emerging on television at the very time that real neighborhoods across America were in major transition, certainly urban neighborhoods, but also with the mass migration to the suburbs, the whole notion of neighborhood itself was being turned on its ear. When you used to be able to go out on the stoop and walk to your bakery and all the rest of it, suddenly we were in these huge Levittowns or Winding Acres estates. And I think that might have been and part of the appeal of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was that as the old-fashioned notion of neighborhood was changing, he provided a surrogate neighborhood. In the 1920s or 30s, you might actually have gone out your door and actually really talked to the various people in your neighborhood. By the time we got to the 1960s, certainly by the 1980s, most parents would never let their kids out the door without supervision for fear of being molested or abducted and all of the rest of those paranoias. So that there was a sense that while we became a more insular, more isolated, nesting kind of society, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood provided us with the neighborhood that had kind of been eliminated from the lives of many Americans. It provides a surrogate set of relationships that for many kids were no longer part of their physical life.
Does anyone else do it? Did anyone else do it? Was it something that Fred Rogers was uniquely capable of pulling off, or was it simply that he was willing to continue to do it when everyone else had become hip and ironic?
Well, that's the interesting question. I mean, other neighborhoods were created. For example, in Sesame Street, there is this neighborhood. There is are these people that live in the place, but it was so much more hip. It was so much more of a happening kind of program. Fred Rogers did what very, very few people in America have been able to do, which is to totally remain as square can be. And that is hard to do since 1982 or so, when we moved into this era of irony and irony just washed over everything that we did. To remain a guy that is just so completely not hip is very hard to do. And I think in the end, that may be Fred Rogers' genius, is he managed to bring something into the 21st century that had not yet been infected by the era of irony. I look back, and in the last few years, we've lost two really unique characters, Charles Schulz and Fred Rogers.
Charlie Brown in the Neighborhood.
Right. And I think when all is said and done, we're going to look back and think that Charles Schulz and Fred Rogers were two of the really nice things about the 20th century.
Is there still an island of appetite for that unironic, that simple, that straightforward? We know that children always respond to it, and God willing, they always will. We have a generation now, and more than a generation, that grew up with Fred Rogers. Is there any echo, any answer to that in adult programming?
No, we're not seeing it yet. Not a single one of the sitcoms. The Wonder Years, I suppose, came close, but it had its own little ironic things to it. I think everyone is too afraid to get that close to one's feeling. You know, Fred Rogers would come right out, Mr. Rogers, and he would say, "I love you. I care for you." I mean, these are things that we wouldn't dare say for fear of being rejected and all of the rest of it. But there is an appetite for this stuff. Of course, kids who have no sense of irony, thankfully, they love this simply because he's this nice, warm character. But there are also times when an adult now who grew up with Fred Rogers will stumble into a room where the TV's been left on, and there it will be. And all of a sudden, that voice will speak, and they'll be transformed to that time when they had foot pajamas on, when there was a warm bowl of oatmeal waiting in the next room, before they had the worries and concerns of school or a job or anything else, and that all of a sudden they are invited for a temporary visit back to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And it is a calm, warm, and happy place to be.
The miracle of videotape means it never has to go away, will it? Do you think children 50 years from now might still be watching this, or will it become so hopelessly beyond what we know in our daily lives that parents can't even imagine turning it on for them?
The only thing that's going to make Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood obsolete is it's going to start to look old-fashioned because of the quality of the film and tape and the costuming and the haircuts. I think the spirit of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood could potentially live on and will live on forever, and somebody, if they're smart, is going to try to do some of the things that he did. The other thing is that most of his audience are kids 5 and under. They don't understand the notion of live versus videotape and all of the rest of it. So that Mr. Rogers, in effect, for 5-year-olds and below, is immortal. As long as that show keeps rerunning, they're going to keep watching it, and they don't know that he's passed on. There he is. He's in his sweater. He's talking in a comforting kind of way. He's making them feel safe and loved and all of the rest of it, and they never have to deal with the fact that he's died, because there he is, alive again through the miracle of television.
Bob Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson is a professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University and On Point's TV critic. We're talking tonight about the late, great, humble Fred Rogers and his neighborhood. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There's only one In this wonderful world, you are special.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and work of Fred Rogers. Here's a clip from his television show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where Fred Rogers is talking to kids about how to communicate what they feel.
There are many ways of saying who you are and how you feel. Ways that can be so helpful. Ways that don't hurt yourself or anybody else. You know, that's how you can tell when you're grown up inside. You're sure that what you're planning and doing are things that can be a real help to you and your neighbor. I'm proud of you, you know that. I hope you do. I'm proud of you, I'm proud of you. I hope that you're as proud as I am. Proud of you, I'm proud of you. I hope that you are proud of you too.
The late, great Fred Rogers, dead today at 74. We're looking at his life and work tonight and the meaning of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. How will we raise the kids without him? And was he part of your childhood, part of your children's neighborhood? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined right now from New York by Gary Nell. He's president and chief executive officer of the Sesame Workshop, where Sesame Street is produced. He also serves on the board of governors for the American Center for Children and Media. Good evening and welcome, Gary Nell.
A pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Gary Nell, Fred Rogers stopped producing his show a couple of years ago. Now he's actually died and gone. You've spent many years at the other side of the television, children's television park. How will you remember him? How will you remember his work?
Well, Tom, we've lost a giant in children's television, as many of your listeners undoubtedly agree. Fred was someone who, remember, was born at a time, just as Sesame Street was born at a time in this country where there was much social upheaval, there was an unpopular war, there was many social strife in this situation, there were racial divides. And we did have people like Fred Rogers come forward, who, by the way, were not big television fans. In fact, he found it to be somewhat uncomfortable to be in, but decided rightfully that it was a critical teaching tool that was going to have the power more than anything probably ever invented of influencing young children. And I think in that context, he created his neighborhood, which, as we just heard that clip, dealt with, you know, critical social and emotional issues around young children. And it's in that tradition, I think, that Sesame Street has also carried on along with other, many other programs today.
A pretty amazing neighborhood, singular in many ways. And we'll talk about the distinctions between Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Sesame Street, and others. But here was Fred Rogers, born 1928, Latrobe, Pennsylvania, just outside Pittsburgh. His family had a brick business. He grew up in a big brick house on the hill. Did get into TV fairly early, Gary Nell. Worked at NBC before he went back to Pittsburgh and helped start WQED there, one of the first local public television stations, I guess. And then, as you say, saw this need at the same time. He went to seminary part time. He was a Presbyterian minister. He was a composer. You can feel that spiritual element, I think, in the very simple kind of homilies that he delivered on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
He did. And you know, many of your listeners, I'm sure, grew up watching Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers back to back. You know, these two powerhouses in children's media have always lived well together as being complementary, not exactly the same, but complementary. Fred focusing really on social and emotional needs of young children, and Sesame Street with cognitive development around letters and numbers and colors and shapes, along with social and emotional as well. But Fred was really able to jump into those issues in a very powerful way, and I think, as you said, almost a spiritual way, which he brought to the screen each and every day, a calming influence in a sea of tension and a sea of some chaos in children's lives. And I think they were able to tune into him for that very special half hour and find their own solitude.
Gary, now listen with me, if you would, to a public service announcement that Fred Rogers did in 2002, telling parents how to talk with their children about news events in a difficult time.
Hello, I'm Fred Rogers. Some parents wonder how to handle world news with their young children. Well, we at Family Communications have discovered that when children bring up something frightening, it's helpful right away to ask them what they know about it. We often find that their fantasies are very different from the actual truth. Probably what children need to hear most from us adults is that they can talk with us about anything, and that we will do all we can to keep them safe in any scary time. I'm always glad to be your neighbor.
Fred Rogers in a public service announcement last year. Gary Neal, you know this field so well. Is this man inimitable? Can there be an heir to Fred Rogers, or did he have a kind of, you know, sui generis humility about him?
Well, I think there's really never going to be another Fred Rogers. I think that we can only learn and follow in his footsteps about the greatness that he had. I was in the White House with him last year, and President and Mrs. Bush presented him with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and he asked everyone in the room, including the President and the First Lady, for a minute of silence. And these are people whose lives are filled with, as you can imagine, world tensions and world affairs, and I think it was a spiritual moment for the audience sitting there, for everyone to think and contemplate about their own lives, their own families, and just take a deep breath, which is, I think, something we could all learn in. I think that following in his footsteps, Tom, many of us agree completely with the clip that you just played, that about the need for parents to discuss things with their children. And the workshop, in fact, is carrying on in Fred's tradition in dealing, frankly, with older kids now from 6 to 11 who are tending to be a bit forgotten by the media these days.
And this is the Sesame workshop that produces Sesame Street.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And what we have found in our research with children in this age group is that parents are actually not communicating with them enough, that their concerns at home about or at school about things like bullying and things that they're seeing in television are not being discussed adequately, and juxtapose that with things like 9/11, where the communities really came in and came together. Parents are not necessarily connecting as well on issues that are most relevant to kids in that age group, and we're now trying to develop some programs to deal with that, and it's in that tradition, I think, that Fred started and in which we and others will continue.
In that younger age group, under 5, that Fred Rogers spoke to, I was struck as a young parent how it was a place for all the jokes that were made about Mr. Rogers. You could just collapse some days with a very young child in front of that and somehow sink into this state of mind that was kind of agog but so gentle. It was a real comfort sometimes, maybe just collapsing out of exhaustion as a parent. I'm sure I'm not alone in having done that. Gary Neal, CEO of Sesame Workshop, stand by. We have Sarah calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that today in school, even though I'm 12 years old, we talked about how we liked Mr. Rogers, and even though we don't watch it anymore, everything we learned from it is really important.
Sarah, you're just 12. Can you remember the years when you used to watch Mr. Rogers?
Yeah, I really didn't. I didn't have any homework, for one thing.
Responsibilities were less than. But what do you remember about it? What did you like about Mr. Rogers?
I really liked his trolley. I don't know why, but as soon as it came into Mr. Rogers' room, it like jingled, and then it sort of had a personality, and it was like Mr. Rogers' other side, sort of.
But you've seen lots of cartoons and PlayStations and all of that. Mr. Rogers was so simple. Did it really pull you in?
Yeah, I was sort of like a teacher before grade school, and there are new things we learned watching the show every single day, like tying your shoes or how to stop bullies or just...
Sarah, if you grow up and have children yourself one day, would you like them to watch Mr. Rogers?
I think so, because it has really good things that you should have to learn in life, really simple ways to put things.
You said it. Sarah, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Gary Nell, stand by. We're joined now by Peggy Charon. She's president and founder of Action for Children's Television, a nonprofit that campaigns for quality children's TV, and the 1995 winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Good evening and welcome, Peggy Charon.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us. Peggy, where do you place Fred Rogers in the universe of children's television? You've tracked it for many years. How would you describe his role, his place?
What's interesting about Fred is that he's so unique as an entertainer and an educator of children.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a world that was getting louder and faster, that world of mass media, pop culture, he was always slow and quiet and managed to get the message out in a way we can all understand, especially if we're under 5 or 6. And what started to happen with television experiences is they got to a point where even I sometimes have trouble making sense out of even my favorite program, West Wing, one commercial television program I watch.
Why? What do you mean, Peggy?
They talk so fast to each other, which is the way it happens in the White House. And sometimes when I'm sitting in front of that screen, I really want to go slower. And he went slow, and it worked.
But do you think anyone else is going to have the nerve to attempt that? I mean, it's not, unless it just comes flat naturally to you, it's not easy to pull off.
I think you don't have to clone Fred to get a program that does the same thing for children. I think Gary is doing that and working on that with his institution, which is a nifty institution. You know, Sesame Street had similar concerns. They did it differently, but they too dealt with death. When Mr. Hooper in the store died, they were very sensitive to how they handled that.
Mm. But Gary Nell, if I may, earlier in the show, before you came on, Bob Thompson was with us from Syracuse University, and he described Mr. Rogers' neighborhood and Sesame Street as in some sense, polar opposite. And the Mr. Rogers was all about a kind of naive simplicity and almost a boring set and pace, whereas Sesame Street uses all the flash animation and when it wants to, the speed and pump it up jazz that's made it in part so popular.
I think that both kinds of programming are appropriate if they start with a concern for the children as children and not as a target market audience to sell product. And that was what is and was the matter with so much of commercial television for children. They really don't care about kids. They care about selling whatever it is they're pitching.
I would just add, Peggy, that, you know, it's really about how we engage children, and there's not a right or a wrong way. But
that's
the
good.
Question here is, as Peggy pointed out, what was the ultimate mission? And the mission was the same. Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers stood together and will stand together as programs which had the mission of using the power of television to help children reach their highest potential. And that is why Big Bird visited the neighborhood on Mr. Rogers and why we had Mr. Rogers on Sesame Street.
But what about this issue, Gary Nell, of tempo itself? Mr. Rogers defied the contemporary tempo of life. Sesame Street doesn't. It runs with it in great degree.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, I think that it's a question of we have people in our lives who are quieter and people who may be a little louder, and it was a different technique to reach kids, not necessarily one or the other. And, you know, even Sesame Street now, some 34 years later, has evolved and is a different program.
Right.
Now, remember that Sesame Street was really created in an era when Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In was hot, and advertising 30-second jingles is what kids were being thrown in front of on Saturday morning cartoons. That in many ways doesn't exist as much anymore with the advent of public television and Nick Jr. not having commercials and things like that and kids having home videos. And their viewing habits have changed. So Sesame Street, to some degrees, has slowed down itself a little bit over the years.
I think there's something else that we should remember, and that is that these programs, particularly, I think, Mr. Rogers, helps parents really as much as it helps kids. Those parents that know enough to watch what their children are watching occasionally really learn from Mr. Rogers how to talk to their children, especially how to talk about things that are difficult.
I mean, in the simplicity, in the kind of a respectful way that he delivered.
Yes, and he's respectful of every audience. I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Rogers over a variety of things we do when we talk about media all the time.
Was he secretly a member of Hell's Angels, or was he just like on TV?
He was exactly like he is on television, to the point where when we would testify in Washington in front of the same hearings, worrying about funding public television or making sure that there's enough choices for children of different ages, Mr. Rogers would talk to me. I find it hard, even though I know him very well and knew him for a long time, to call him Fred. To me, I think he'll always be Mr. Rogers in his sweater and sneakers.
Yes, he sure will.
And the thing that was interesting is that he would talk to me about myself, just the way he talks to children about themselves, never about himself. Mm-hmm. And by the time he got through shaking my hand in a warm way, the only other person who ever did that was Bill Clinton. Has the same kind of handshake.
So he had won you right over.
It's a very caring handshake. And I felt like I was 5 years old by the time we got through talking, because everybody has to hear that they're terrific.
I guess they do. Peggy, Gary, I want to get one more call before a break coming up. Jay is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hey, I grew up with Fred Rogers and just loved it. It was a place where you could let down your guard and relax and had that sort of innocence that you really didn't see in any other programs that I remembered at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sitting here listening to the program, and I thought, what is the version for adults? And I think the closest thing is maybe Garrison. Oh, my phone is going off.
Life is busy
classic,
now.
Classic noise in life.
Right.
The Garrison Keillor program that's on every week.
Does it calm you down in the same way, Jay?
His voice is the same slow voice.
Now, that's true. Yeah,
it's the adult version. And every morning, I don't know when it's on here in Madison, but there's the Writer's Almanac, which is like a maybe a 3 to 5 minute program where he reads a little bit of poetry and talks about who was born this day and some significant historical event that happened. And he ends it with a poem, and he always ends it with "Be well, do good, and keep in touch." And it's just I used to plan my mornings around it and wake up and have everything eaten by then.
Maybe there, Jay, with Garrison Keillor, you found your adult Mr. Rogers. I don't know what Garrison Keillor would think of the comparison. Maybe he'd love it. Jay, thanks for calling from Madison. We're talking tonight about the late, great, humble Fred Rogers and the meaning of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. You can join the conversation. Did Mr. Rogers make you feel special, loved, safe? The show didn't change for 30 years. Why did it still speak to us? And is there still a place in your heart for Lady Elaine, Daniel Tiger, Trolley Trolley, King Friday? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
There's the eating way to say I love you. There's the eating something someone made especially. The eating way, the eating way, the eating way to say I love you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and legacy of Fred Rogers. Here's a clip from his television show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where he teaches children about immunizations by getting a booster shot himself.
Hi, neighbor. We're together again. Did you wonder why I didn't put on my sweater right away? Well, I'm going to the clinic to get an immunization, so I thought we could talk about it beforehand. I'll roll up my sleeve. And this is where I'll get the immunization. And the medicine that they put into me is to help me stay healthy. Have you ever had an immunization? Some people call it a shot or an injection. Well, if you'd like to see me get one, you can come along with me. And you can come along with me now.
Let's just go to the doctor's office at the clinic so you can see what it's like.
And there it would be, the sleeve rolled up, not buff, but so for real, Mr. Rogers. Who else, what else in TV today can carry the torch for Fred Rogers? Can anyone else wear the cardigan and sneakers? Do we still have the capacity for that kind of humility? And how do we feel the kids, make the kids feel safe? Now you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight with Peggy Sharon. She's president and founder of Action for Children's Television. And Gary Nell, president and CEO of the Sesame Workshop, where Sesame Street is produced. Rob's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. When we moved, my wife and I, to Pittsburgh, we actually moved into Fred Rogers' neighborhood.
Get out.
He actually welcomed my wife to the neighborhood.
That sounds like a line for a joke. Are you serious, Rob?
Very serious. She was a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh School of Library and Information Science, and they were having a sweater drive and for the disadvantaged. And,
yeah,
of course, Fred Rogers came down to help it, and he met my wife and started talking with her and said, "Oh, where are you living?" And they, you know, she told him and said, "Well, welcome to the neighborhood."
And did she, like our guest Peggy Sharon, have the feeling that this was not just Fred Rogers, but Mr. Rogers addressing her?
Absolutely. And we talked about it a lot that day. We had both, of course, watched him as kids growing up. And she said, "You know what? He really is that person that you see on the television. That's him. He's not acting."
Absolutely right.
Do you have kids now watching Mr. Rogers yourself, Rob?
Well, we have two children, and one is very precocious. She's a very smart two-year-old, and we are going to have to, she's not quite ready to be watching that,
right,
but we have decided that we're going to have to get some of his programs on video so she can see it, because you know, he had the kind of show, we realize now as parents, that you can leave on and leave the room and
that's
trust
right,
that, you know, that he'll impart good messages to your children.
You don't have to monitor Fred Rogers. Robert,
yeah,
it's a great point, and thank you for your story about meeting him in your own neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Peggy Sharon, I wonder today what portion of shows are out there that parents can trust in that way?
Not very many in that way. The idea that you should know what your children are looking at and watch with them whenever possible is really a very good thing for most parents to pay attention to, because there's so much that isn't appropriate. Even if it's not terrible, it may not be the kind of messages that your child can deal with or that you want them to hear. And if you're there as a mediator between the child and the set, that really helps tremendously. But with Fred Rogers, it's the trust that he built up with American parents and with their children. When you watch him over time, you know, more than just a few times, and I realize I must have watched a lot of Mr. Rogers
over the years,
because everything that everybody talked about today in terms of illustrating what he's like, I saw that show.
Right.
Now, I have a feeling that what was I doing? Was I doing anything except watching
Mr. Rogers? Let me ask you this, Peggy Sharon, because you track this overall, what percentage of television that's put on the air today for children, to your mind, falls in a category that you'd call good, quality, you know, worthy?
As a First Amendment person from way back, as somebody who thinks that censorship is worse than any kind of junk on television, and I would keep having mild fights with the child advocates who wanted to get rid of television programs. I think the only way to get rid of what isn't good for children is to use the off button.
But what portion is good?
And there's a lot of good stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good in the way public broadcasting is really good, because public broadcasting has a mandate to educate. And they really have to say to funders and to people who are making that television channel work that this is what we tried to do, and this is how we did it, and this is the results that we came to after we examined whether it worked or not.
So between Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers, maybe the way has been shown forward a little more positively. Tamara is calling from Ashby, Massachusetts. Hi, Tamara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thanks. I just wanted to offer some comments, being from a troubled divorced family, has a child, mm-hmm. and really depending on Mr. Rogers for just a way to escape, even if just for a half hour a day.
Do you mean when you were a child, when you were young, Tamara?
Yeah, yeah. And now, as a mother of a 2- and 3-year-old, there was just always so much safety in it for me. And like your last caller had said, you can put the TV on and walk away and know that it's something that your children can watch.
But when you were a girl and family life was tough, this was a place you found refuge?
Definitely, definitely. But from the opening line, you know, welcome to my neighborhood, it's, you know, he was glad to see me and offering, you know, just a little bit of help along the way has, you know, a 4- and 5-year-old, just it's, and
we can hear what it meant to you, Tamara, and thank you for calling and sharing that with us. I've got a quote here where Fred Rogers said, "The world is not always a kind place. That's something all children learn for themselves, whether we want them to or not, but it's something they really need our help to understand." Gary Nelt, do you see pieces, threads of the Fred Rogers approach in other shows today? Can you point to them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that he really was the pioneer in dealing with emotional needs of children on television. And, you know, the thing that he kept that was unique was an underlying respect for children. He never spoke at them. He spoke with them. And it was a very powerful technique to use television to engage children in that way, to engage them in important life lessons, to demystify the world. And I think that it is that trend which I think has been certainly picked up by Sesame Street in our own way. But there are many shows now that Peggy mentioned and others on public television, like Arthur and Dragon Tales and other programs, which have carried on in dealing with social and emotional needs of children in a way in which they're really engaged. And that didn't really exist prior to Fred Rogers. So I think that he will go down in history as the one who really created a genre for children's television that will go on and on for many years.
Peggy, I wonder, not to be completely soupy about Fred Rogers, we have to acknowledge he was the butt of a million jokes. I mean, once you passed a certain age, of course, I guess they were lovable, but it was almost like, was he like the nutty old aunt or uncle who you make fun of when they're around, and when they're gone, you think, oh my gosh.
I think that's because they weren't comfortable in their own skins, people who really took Fred Rogers apart for being so nice.
I suppose a lot of it was loving ribbing that it got. Just raising it in humor was a way to raise it and be comforted, even in the joke.
I think humor is terrific. And when Saturday Night Live did a piece on Mr. Rogers, I was rolling on the floor.
Eddie Murphy, it's a hell of a day in the neighborhood. He had
it. That's right. And I think that when somebody makes his points clearly and becomes a kind of icon, that kind of ribbing, that kind of satire happens, and it's terrific. It's not bad. It makes you love him all the more to be able to see him the way some of these funny skits saw him. And I think that people who are mean, who say, what's that guy doing on television, really don't understand themselves, and they don't understand their need for that kind of caring attitude. And I think probably their children suffer because of it.
We've just got a few seconds left, but Peggy, does it matter even now for someone to turn to children on television and say to them, you're special?
I think it matters for children to hear that from everybody they know. And it matters to hear that when you're worried about something you did and you think it's wrong. It matters when you see miserable things happening on television every day, all day. Not just the big accidents, but life the way it's lived now doesn't seem to be warm and fuzzy. And children need a warm and fuzzy life.
Gary, you're going to keep a piece of this alive in Sesame Street?
Oh, for sure. You know, don't forget, television teaches. And it teaches good things and it teaches bad things. And I think it's up to those of us who care about our children to use the powerful medium of television to engage kids about those life lessons that Fred and others committed their lives to doing.
Gary and Peggy Charon, we're out of time, but I want to thank you both so much for being on. Gary Nell is president and CEO of the Sesame Workshop, where Sesame Street is produced. Thanks for joining us, Gary.
Thank you.
And Peggy Charon, here in Boston, president and founder of Action for Children's Television. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for existing.
You're both very special. We're going to close this segment of our program with the song Fred Rogers sang on the last episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. This is On Point.
A snappy new day. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling. The feeling you know that I'll be back when the week is new. And I'll have more ideas for you. And you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will, too. Be back next time. Bye.
Poetry is a resource, says Pulitzer Prize-winning poet C.K. Williams. At certain times, people seem to need it or want it or can find sustenance in it. And at other times, they can't. And right now, it's a good time. For tonight's radio diary, here's C.K. Williams reading one of his latest poems, The Hearth.
The Hearth. Alone after the news on a bitter evening in the country, sleet slashing the stubbled fields, the river ice, I keep stirring up the recalcitrant fire, but when I throw my plastic coffee cup in with new kindling, it perches intact on a log for a strangely long time, as though uncertain what to do, until, in a somehow reluctant, almost creaturely way, it dents, collapses, and decomposes to a dark slime entwining itself on the stone hearth. I once knew someone who was caught in a fire and made it sound something like that. He'd been loading a bomber and a napalm shell had gone off. Flung from the flames, at first he felt nothing and thought he'd been spared. But then came the pain, then the hideous dark. He'd been blinded and so badly charred he spent years in recovery. Agonizing debridements, grafts, learning to speak through a mouth without lips, to read braille with fingers lavered with scar, to not want to die, though that never happened. He swore, even years later with a family, that if he were back there, this time allowed to put himself out of his misery, he would. There was dying here tonight, after dusk, by the road, an owl, eyes fixed and flared, breast so winter white he seemed to shine a searchlight on himself, helicoptered near a wire fence, then suddenly banked, plunged, and vanished into the swallowing dark with his prey. Such an uncomplicated departure, no detonation, nothing to mourn. If the creature being torn from its life made a sound, I didn't hear it. But in truth, I wasn't listening. I was thinking, as I often do these days, of war. I was thinking of my children and their children, of the more than fear I feel for them, and then of radar, rocket, shrapnel, cities razed, soil poisoned for 1,000 generations, of suffering so vast it nullifies everything else. I stood in the wind, in the raw cold, wondering how those with power over us can affect such things, and by what cynical reasoning pardon themselves. The fire's ablaze now. Its glow on the windows makes the night even darker, but it barely keeps the room warm. I stoke it again and crouch closer.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet C.K. Williams reading his poem, The Hearth, for On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.